Hello, this is Tom Heck with TeachMeTeamwork.com, and on the line with me today is Ron McMillan, who is the co-author of the 2005 New York Times bestseller, Crucial Confrontations, Tools for Resolving Broken Promises, Violated Expectations, and Bad Behavior. Ron is the Vice President of Consulting Services and co-founder of Vital Smarts, a global leader in organizational performance and leadership. He has taught and consulted around topics including team development, personal vitality, quality, communication, and results-oriented leadership for more than 20 years. Ron has co-founded Covey Leadership Center and was Vice President of Research and Development for 7 years. And Ron has worked with a broad variety of groups, ranging from union and first-level managers to CEOs and corporate executives. Ron, I'd like to welcome you to the call.
Well, thank you, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Well, we're going to be talking about your book today, Crucial Confrontations. And I want to read you two lines out of the book, right out of the beginning in the introduction, page 11. And it says here, "Behind every national disaster, organizational failure, and family breakdown, you find the same root cause. People are staring into the face of a crucial confrontation, and they're not sure what to say." That's a big statement.
Pretty audacious claim.
It is an audacious claim. How did you come to be able to make a claim like that?
Well, in part, it came from 20 years of hitting my head against the wall trying to solve problems in complex organizations. More and more, we begin to realize, my co-authors and I, that no matter what the problem is it a quality problem, is it a safety problem, productivity problem, is it a cost-cutting problem, these problems can't be solved without bringing people together.
Mm.
You bring people together, you work through the issue, come up with solutions, and then you have to execute. But if people aren't effective in communicating and problem-solving, then all of these wonderful processes we use to try and solve problems are for naught. We begin saying so much rides on people's ability to communicate.
Okay, so when you said, you've mentioned problems a couple times, is it, in all of the teams that you've worked with, organizations, are some organizations more prone to problems because of their how they deal with them? I mean, in other words, if we don't have the skills to deal with a problem well, does that mean that more problems surface?
You know, that's an excellent question, Tom. It's kind of a hard one to answer. Let me dance around it a little bit, if I could. And that is, there might be a company out there that's in a mature industry, and the best way to succeed is steady as she goes.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to face fewer problems than a brand new startup in a turbulent market.
Mm-hmm.
However, we found the key to success isn't the number of problems you have.
Mm-hmm.
The key to success is, are we getting rid of the problems we faced last year? Are we solving them? Are we dealing with them in ways that advance us? And so it isn't so much what's the problem we're facing as what's our approach to solving this problem.
And in this book, you mentioned that it seems as though it's not just little problems, but how to deal with those really difficult ones.
Yeah. We really carefully chose the word crucial.
Mm-hmm.
Because we weren't so interested in saying, how do you have a real tough conversation with someone where you're afraid of hurting their feelings? Or how do you have a touchy conversation, or how do you deal with a difficult one? What we were interested in is those conversations who have the biggest impact on results and relationships, those conversations that are crucial to our results and outcomes.
Mm.
Those are the ones where we saw people stumble and fall. Those are the ones where we saw people get flustered, where the stress pushed them towards some sort of violence or silence. We said, how do you handle those most crucial of confrontations, those crucial to results and relationships? And that actually became the target focus of our research.
And I gotta read here in the introduction here. This is great. It says, we watched a vice president confront a chief financial officer he believed was embezzling from the company. We looked in as a physician told her medical director that he was dangerously incompetent, so incompetent that the other physicians scheduled risky surgeries for times when he wasn't on duty. I mean, that's pretty serious.
It is very serious and crucial to the success of an individual team or organization.
So what you watched or observed 25,000 people?
Yeah.
And so what happens when you, I mean, what did you begin to see early on with all of these difficult and challenging conversations?
Well, we began our research in 1990, and literally it was a 12-year research effort.
Wow.
We hadn't intended for it to be that big or go on that long. But in fact, what would happen is as we got access to organizations, we'd do questionnaires and surveys and have people identify the most effective, influential leaders and communicators they work with. Once these individuals had been identified, then we began studying them and comparing the very best with the really good. There are a lot of good managers and leaders out there. Mm-hmm. What was the difference between what they did and the very best as identified by those who work with them?
Mm.
What we begin realizing is that there were a set of skills, a set of approaches that literally differentiated the good from the best.
Mm.
And we started seeing this over and over again. Over that 12-year period, we clocked over 10,000 hours of observation.
Wow.
Watching some of these master communicators in action, these most influential business leaders. We began cataloging what are the interpersonal skills they use that differentiate them, and we identified 23 different interpersonal skills, and we said, what are the approaches that differentiates them? We began to identify a very consistent problem-solving approach which these master communicators would use in the most crucial of confrontations. We began to realize that we were onto something because we could use the presence or absence of this approach to predict who was perceived by those they work with as being good versus who was perceived as being magnificent, incredible.
Wow.
So we realized not only could we use this research to predict who is most effective and who is less effective, but we began realizing these skills can be trained. People can acquire these skills. And now, in the crucial confrontations, we've trained over 300 people ranging from Singapore to Cincinnati and found that any reasonably intelligent, reasonably educated person can learn these skills, apply them, and realize terrific results.
So share with our listeners what happens after you learn these. What changes do you see when maybe 6 months later after you've trained these people in the organization or a year later? Can you give us a before and after picture?
Sure. Before, an average leader in an organization, depending on their job, this percentage might change, but for most of us, 90% of our communication is routine, regular, and they do just really fine.
Mm-hmm.
90% of the time, their communication is effective. And in fact, to be honest, 90% of the time, as we did observations, we could not differentiate between the very best and the simply good or good enough.
Wow.
However, the casual or routine conversation turns crucial when three factors come together.
Okay.
The first factor is high stakes.
Okay.
This is important. Something's at risk to either be gained or lost.
Okay.
Now, we found if two people are having a high stakes conversation and both agree, no problem. But if they disagree, you've got high stakes and opposing opinions. That almost always creates strong emotions.
Okay.
And when the casual conversation turns crucial is when these three factors come together. High stakes, opposing opinions, strong emotions. This communication has just turned crucial. And in these most crucial of communications, that's where most of us end up doing our very worst. In fact, we coined a phrase, when it matters the very most of us do our very worst. And that's where we saw these master communicators absolutely shine. Well, you ask, what's the difference? We find that when these crucial communications come together, that most people check out. They go to silence. They cave in. They give in. They give up. They refuse to have it. Go to great lengths to avoid it. Mm. When people go through the training and they learn there are very effective ways to deal with these very stressful situations, the number one difference we see between someone who's learned these skills and haven't, someone who used to avoid conversations and now they step up to them, is they have a sense of what to do, they have a confidence that they can do it well, and they have a belief this will have a positive outcome.
Now, do both sides, did you have to train both sides, or is it work effectively, do these skills work effectively if the other person has never been presented with this information?
We found the very best situation is everyone on the team has learned these skills and this approach.
Okay.
If we all have them in common, then we create kind of a shorthand with each other. And you can actually move very efficiently, very effectively. There's an expectation about how we'll deal with these things. And it's amazing how much more effective a team can be when the whole team shares these skills. And we also found if the other person doesn't know these skills, the other person's never heard of them, mm-hmm. but one individual does, that one individual can bring about significantly better outcomes and much stronger relationships just by applying these skills in their approach. The other person doesn't know exactly what they're doing, but they know it works better when this person does. And so it tends to create better outcomes whether or not the other person's familiar with these skills. If the other person's familiar, then it magnifies it. It's much easier. It moves much faster.
So the master communicators that you talked about, did they? How can you explain how they got to be so good? In other words, I'm guessing that most everyone, including myself, you know, were, who wants to be in a confrontation? You know, the title of the book, Crucial Confrontations, it's, I would imagine most people want to avoid a confrontation.
That's exactly right. Most people do want to avoid them. And we talk about being adverse to conflict. Mm-hmm. I think that describes probably about 80% of the population in the United States. Mm-hmm. That's how most people handle crucial confrontations, is they avoid them. A much fewer percent, and it could be, you know, 10%, 15%, they deal with them by taking them head on and thrashing about for what they really want. We call that going violent in a crucial confrontation. Most of us go silent, some go violent, and we found there's a tremendous price to pay when you handle a crucial confrontation in either of those ways.
Okay.
If we give in to our tendency and go silent, we find one of the first impacts on teams and organizations is that standards drop.
Mm.
If we're all working together as a team, one of the team members is not pulling his or her weight, and the leader doesn't confront it, that tells all of us, oh, it's okay. It's okay to do that. It's okay to work less hard, to pull less vigorously, and literally the standards of a team start to drop. But we found there are even more dangerous and horrific consequences when people go silent. All of your listeners are familiar with Enron.
Right.
I'm of the opinion Enron wasn't caused by a greedy CEO.
Mm.
I think Enron was caused by 100 silent accomplices.
Yes.
Literally, someone goes to their boss and says, excuse me, this is a very irregular financial procedure,
mm-hmm.
and the boss says, don't worry about it.
Mm.
And they say, okay, I won't. It literally took 100 people refusing to confront error for Enron to happen. I don't work directly with them, but a friend of mine who consults with them, he believes a culture of silence, a culture of avoidance, killed 7 astronauts. In healthcare, there are thousands that die every year because people will refuse to confront a doctor or a physician.
Yes.
These are not minor issues, and going silent, there's a tremendous price to pay. Well, we found there's also a tremendous price to pay for going violent. And violent is kind of weird in a crucial confrontation. Most of us avoid him. Some of us, we just go in and thrash it. We figure we're in the fight of our lives. And what's interesting about that is often, if we're really good, or especially if we have more organizational power than someone else, we're a higher rank, say, when we go violent, people scurry around, and it appears we're getting what we want.
Mm.
But we found when people go violent in a crucial confrontation, there's something called the law of the hog. And the law of the hog was actually born as we were doing studying a large wood products company. And we found when supervisors bullied their employees,
yes,
when there was a problem and they'd go in and bully people and order people around, that people would do what the supervisor said until her back was turned.
Mm.
And then they would take good wood, already milled, ready to go to the customer, and they'd take it down to the hog.
Oh.
And that was the term they used for this industrial-grade chipper. And they would put good wood into the hog. They would actually grind up good wood into sawdust as a way of getting back,
yeah.
or getting even with the supervisor, because the supervisor's job's productivity, and all of a sudden productivity's dropping, scrap is going up or waste, a supervisor can't figure out how to turn it around, and it was an intentional effort by employees to get back at someone who had gone violent with them or been rude or bullied or been disrespectful. And so the law of the hog is the price we pay when we go violent. The compromising of standards becomes the price we pay when we go silent in these crucial confrontations.
Well, I'd like to move into there's 4 mistakes people make when confronting others. And before we move into there, it sounds as if there's got to be a shift that is made that that confronting is better than not.
Yes.
And confronting in a conscious way is better than just railing and getting mad. And when I met you, we were up in Milwaukee, and you were a speaker in the morning, and I loved you had a great story about a young man who was testing some of this. Maybe you can share this. This is fantastic. I think it shows what happens when how we behave culturally, and maybe here's the story that I remember is that a young man had someone videotaping him, and he jumped in front of a line or butted in front of people. So there's a long line, and a young man gets in and sort of butts in front of some other people to see what would happen. What would they say? Could you just briefly share that?
Yeah, isn't that funny?
It's a great story.
The 12-year-old son of my co-author, Joseph Grenny, had a science project. And instead of making a foaming volcano, he decided to get a video camera and test his dad's theories.
I love it.
So he went to the mall during a busy holiday season.
Yeah.
And he and his buddy, they randomly picked 25 people. They interviewed them,
mm-hmm.
said, what would you do if someone cut in front of you in a line?
Mm-hmm.
All 25 said, well, I would say something like, excuse me, the line forms the rear. So
right.
All 25 said they would confront it.
Right.
Then he and his buddy, on video, they just started butting into different lines in front of people to see how they would respond.
Right, and they hid the video. It wasn't
yep.
evident that the video was right there in front of them.
That's exactly right.
Right.
So they videotaped themselves butting into to line 25 different times and not one person confronted them.
Oh, my gosh. Now, and what I remember, you showed some video clips, is that you saw people talking, like, about that young man doing that.
Oh, the people behind would get angry.
Yeah.
They would turn to each other, and they'd make snide remarks, but no one would say anything to him.
Right.
Well, he started getting suspicious. He thought, well, maybe it's just because I'm a little kid. You know, I'm only 12. So he talked his mom into doing it. And we got this on video, too.
Oh, my God.
So his mom made 25 line cuts, and only one person spoke to her.
What did she say?
She tapped her on the shoulder. His mom turned around, and she said, "Who does your hair?"
So what does this tell you? What is the message for us all here?
Well, I need to quickly add that this experiment was replicated on Times Square, and after one line cutting and the guy got beat up and thrown to the pavement, we decided it may be regionally specific.
That I didn't know.
Yeah, that in fact, in some areas of the country, there's a regional nice mode of operation. In other areas, that doesn't exist. But what we found is it really is illustrative of the fact that most of us are adverse to conflict.
Mm-hmm.
Even when it's in our best interest, we hesitate to confront, even if it's with strangers. Why go through the hassle? Why go through the unpleasantries? Better to just let things stand as they are, and we pay a horrific price when we do.
Yes. Well, okay, so let's move into some real skills here. There's you have four key mistakes people make when confronting others. Mistake number one, what is that?
There are many, many mistakes people make, and if they, even if they didn't know the skills, if they just corrected the mistakes, they would do so much better.
Mm-hmm.
Of the many they could make, we found four that are chronic. It seems like people do these all the time.
Okay.
The first one is we confront the wrong problem.
Okay, what does that mean?
Well, many times in our research we found the best predictor of whether or not someone would confront a problem is whether they saw the problem as easy or hard.
Mm.
Hard problems people would avoid, easy ones they would confront. So often, we confront the easy problem rather than the hard problem. So if I were to give an example, say in a team setting, there's someone who is just a cynic. They're really critical when people put ideas out. They're sarcastic.
Mm-hmm.
They put the people down as well as the idea. And so I'm in a meeting, and I make a proposal, and the cynic digs right in, says, "This is a stupid idea. It'll never work." And says, "Come to think of it, you're stupid. You know, I don't know why you're putting these dumb ideas out." Well, after the meeting, I'm really feeling ticked off. So I go over to the cynic. I decide to confront him.
Mm-hmm.
I say, "You know, you called my idea dumb and stupid. It's got a lot of merit, and I would appreciate in the future you discussing the merits rather than just labeling my idea." Now, in that situation, I confronted a problem, him labeling my idea as stupid.
Mm-hmm.
But actually, I picked the easiest problem. The problem I should have confronted is you calling me an idiot, you calling me stupid, and the fact that this is an ongoing pattern, not a one-time incident.
Mm-hmm.
So often, when we do get the courage to confront, instead of confronting the right problem, we confront the easiest problem, or the most recent problem, or the problem we think will cause us the least amount of trouble. If we're successful in that confrontation, it still doesn't solve the big problem, and often what we just solved was a symptom rather than a cause.
Okay. So how does someone... It seems like that they again, they're avoiding the sort of the pain that they are associating with dealing with the actual root cause of the problem. And you know, they get into that situation, then what if the person says, "That's right, you are stupid," or you know, "Why are you taking it so personally? I don't really," you know, and they just kind of blow it off.
And I think that's what we're afraid of, and that's why we tend to gravitate toward either the easiest problem or the most painful or most recent problem.
Mm-hmm.
is we're afraid we don't know what to do with it.
Right.
If, in fact, we get the worst behavior we expect from the other person, there's some skills in a process we can rely upon that'll get us through that.
Yeah.
So absent the knowledge of what to do in those most difficult of responses, then, again, we're inclined to avoid it, ignore it, or go with the easier problem.
Right.
So that's why we say confronting the wrong problem is a huge mistake.
Okay. So mistake number two.
Mistake number two is we tell ourselves a story. And one of the things that came out of our research that really has made a huge difference in people's lives is we've come to recognize that my mom doesn't make me mad. My boss doesn't make me mad. My coworker doesn't make me mad. Rather, it's the story I tell myself about my mom that makes me mad. It's the story I tell myself about my boss or my coworker. Our stories tend to create our emotions.
Okay, you're going to have to clarify this one. Give me an example.
Okay. Friend of mine, he considers himself a strict parent.
Okay.
So he had some really strict rules about his kids. One of them is they couldn't date till they're 16.
Mm-hmm.
Well, his 15-year-old daughter turned 16 and said, "Can I date?" He said, "Well, if you're going to date, there's some serious rules we have." And he reviewed the rules with her about no alcohol, no tobacco, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
"And by the way, we have a strict curfew at 11:30. You'll be home by 11:30 when you date."
Mm-hmm.
He said, "Are you willing to abide by these rules?" She says, "Yes." Well, she comes back to dad, says, "A cute boy asked me out. Can I go?" He says, "Will you keep the rules?" She said, "Yes." So the cute boy shows up to take her out. Dad invites the cute boy in, sits him down, and to his daughter's chagrin, begins reviewing all the rules with her date. He says, "Do you promise to keep these rules?" Her intimidated boyfriend said, "Yes." And he said, "Then you can date my daughter."
Okay.
Well, that night, 11:30 comes around and no daughter.
And this is the first date.
First date.
Right.
11:45, no daughter, no phone call.
Oh, boy.
Midnight, no daughter, no phone call. He is getting furious.
Oh, boy.
12:10, he hears the key slide in the lock. Lock turns, front door opens. His daughter quietly steps in, closes the door, turns around, and dad's about 6 inches from her face. He said, "You're late." And all of a sudden he sniffs, and there was a smell that smelled like strong alcohol mixed with burning alfalfa.
Mm.
And he said, "You've been drinking." He says, "You're late, you've been drinking, you violated our rules, you are restricted for 2 months, you will not go anywhere, you'll come home straight after school, now get up to your room." She said, but dad, he said, "Don't you but dad me, you get up there right now."
Mm.
So she goes up to her room crying. Well, the next morning, dad wakes up, daughter wakes up, dad's cooled down a bit, starts talking to her about the evening before. Now, another rule dad has is trust your kids, but verify.
Okay.
So after hearing what she had to say, he made some calls, made some visits, found out what she said was accurate. It's true. Here's what happened.
Okay.
She goes out with the cute boy. They go to a movie, have a good time. Afterward, they go get some ice cream, and then they start for her house. Plenty of time to get home on time. They go past a friend's house, and there's a bunch of cars parked. Her date says, "Party. Let's go see what's going on." She goes, "I need to be home by 11:30. He says, "Don't worry, we won't be late." Walks in, and she looks around, and every single rule her father had talked to her about is being violated at this party.
Oh, boy.
Including some her father hadn't even thought of. There's no parental supervision.
Oh, boy.
She turns to her date and says, "Please take me home." He said, "We'll just be here a few minutes." And she goes, "I don't feel comfortable. Please take me home." He said, "Then find your own way." And he joined in the party. So the daughter calls home, line's busy. Calls home, line's busy. Calls home, line's busy. Unbeknownst to dad, their 13-year-old daughter, in violation of the family rules, is awake downstairs talking to all her friends on the phone, tying up the line. Dad doesn't even know that. Well, when the daughter can't get through to home, she starts calling all her friends. Finally calls a friend that she knows works at a restaurant. She explains her situation. The friend says, "As soon as I get off work, I'll come over and get you, take you straight home." So the daughter's sitting there. The kids at the party notice she isn't participating. They try to encourage her to drink. She says no. They force it on her, spill it all over her. She walks out, sits on the curb in the dark, in the cold, waiting for her ride. The ride picks her up, takes her straight home, and after doing everything her father would have wanted her to do in that circumstance, what kind of greeting does she get?
Right.
Yelling, screaming, blaming. Now, I took a little detail on that story because I really want us all to see what's happening here. Dad is disappointed his daughter doesn't show up on time. We call a confrontation anytime there's a gap between what you expected and what you get. Anytime there's a gap between the performance standard and the way people are performing. Anytime there's a gap between what should be and what is, that's a confrontation. A confrontation in need of having. So there's a gap between when his daughter shows up and the time that she agreed to. So Dad needs to have this confrontation. However, as Dad's waiting, as there's no phone call, as it gets later in the evening, Dad starts to tell himself a story to explain why this gap exists. So our stories are our assumptions, our conclusions, our judgments. It's the meaning we create out of a recognition that a gap exists. Well, in this case, the story Dad told himself is his daughter's rebellious. His daughter doesn't respect him or respect the family values or rules. So when Dad tells himself that story, that creates very strong anger and frustration in Dad. Another way of saying that, being disappointed, Dad holds court in his head, finds his daughter guilty, and then as soon as he opens up his mouth, begins to exact punishment. Well, what happens is Dad's fuming, the daughter walks in the door, and Dad just lashes out. He goes violent in this crucial confrontation, not only undermining the results he cares about, which is the commitment to the rules in the future, but undermining the relationship. That's what Dad cares most about, and he's digging himself a pretty deep hole. So when we say that one of the biggest mistakes we make in a crucial confrontation is we tell ourselves stories. These stories blame the other people. It ascribes motives. It says that they don't care, they're lazy, they're evil, they're selfish. And those stories create very strong anger in us. And that anger pushes us toward violence, like with Dad, or silence, where we just shut down, withdraw, give the other person the cold shoulder, give them the silent treatment. And literally, our own strong emotions are the biggest barrier to effectively dealing with crucial confrontations.
So, replay it. The daughter walks in. What would you have the father do?
You know, I would have it start the moment the dad realizes there's a gap. There's a gap between what his daughter committed to and what is occurring. Mm-hmm. She's not showing up on time.
Mm-hmm.
As soon as Dad recognizes a gap, he should recognize we all have a tendency to assume the worst about others' motives when we're hurt or disappointed.
Mm-hmm.
We have a tendency to convict them in our head, in the court of our mind. We have found that there's a very powerful set of skills that we had to interview these master communicators to discover what it was. And it's whenever they make a judgment of someone else, they begin questioning their story, automatically questioning their story. In fact, we came up with a little script question that I really encourage people to use. Whenever you're disappointed or let down, immediately sit down and ask yourself, why would a reasonable, rational, decent person let me down? Why would a reasonable, rational, decent person not keep their commitment to me?
Mm-hmm.
If I can have the presence of mind to ask myself that question, the answer to that question will give me alternative explanations other than the worst possible. If Dad had said, why would a reasonable, rational daughter let me down? Now, for some of us, if that's too much of a stretch for a teenager, just say, why would a good kid let me down? Well, the first thing that comes to mind is, I don't know, maybe she had car trouble. Maybe they ran out of gas.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe there was a tie-up on the freeway. Maybe there was an accident.
They're developing, the dad is developing more than one story.
Yes, that's exactly right. Literally, what he's doing is questioning the worst possible story he could tell himself, which is, she's rebellious, she doesn't respect me, she doesn't respect our rules or our values. That's about the worst way he could possibly interpret his daughter being late.
Mm.
Yet that's our tendency, is to assume the worst when we're hurt or let down.
Mm.
So the question, why would a good kid not show up on time, helps me question my judgment and think of alternative explanations. Now, theoretically, what's literally happening here is I'm reframing the situation. You and I get to choose, is the glass half empty or half full? We get to choose our stories. When I question my story, my assumption that she's evil and selfish, and I think there's alternative explanations, which of these five alternative explanations is true? Or is my original bad conclusion the truth? The truth is, I don't know.
Mm.
So I'm replacing my certainty that she's bad and wrong with a question mark. I don't know why this gap exists. As our certainty that she's bad and wrong, which creates anger, changes to a question mark. I don't know why this is happening. Our strong anger turns to curiosity, caring. If we're really good at this skill, it can even turn into compassion. And now, instead of being angry and upset when my daughter walks through the door, I'm wondering, why is this happening? What's going on? Maybe I ought to talk to her instead of yell at her.
Mm.
And that can make all the difference in the world.
That's great. Okay, so tell us about mistake number three.
Mistake number three is the first 30 seconds when we open our mouth in a crucial confrontation, we call the hazardous half minute.
I'm thinking of the dad here.
That's exactly right. The first thing you say in those 30 seconds is going to set the tone for the whole confrontation that follows.
Mm.
It's going to tell that person whether or not they better draw out their sword and shield because they better do battle with me, or whether I'm reasonable, rational, talking to them, and they can sit down and talk with me. Dad blew that hazardous half minute.
Mm-hmm.
He began with accusations that were emotionally driven and drove his daughter to tears, right?
Mm-hmm.
We have found that first 30 seconds, what you say, sets the tone for everything that will follow. And what most of us do in that first 30 seconds is we either begin with an accusation, or we begin with a judgment, or we begin by attributing motive, or we begin, and some of us were actually trained to do this one, with an I statement of emotion. I am so angry with you. I am so disappointed with you.
Mm.
We found that as a beginning statement in a crucial confrontation creates as much defensiveness as a judgment or an accusation.
Mm.
So don't start with any of those. Don't start with any of those. Rather, here's a really simple skill. It's probably the simplest skill in the whole book and one of the most powerful. When you're beginning a crucial confrontation, in the first 30 seconds, the hazardous half minute, describe the gap. That's the skill.
Okay, so what would the dad say?
What he would say is, first, he would factually describe what's happened.
Okay.
The way we say it in the book is, safely and factually describe what's the occurrence. So Dad would say, honey, you agreed with me you'd be home by 11:30. It's now 12:10.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't cast aspersions on her character. He doesn't question her motivation. And when you're confronting with someone else, you don't disparage their ancestry. All you do is factually describe what's occurred.
Okay.
Let me take it into a different situation real fast. You go up to an employee who's late for work.
Okay.
The first thing that comes out of your mouth is, I noticed today you came in at 8:20. We find that it's very hard to argue with facts, and that facts minimize defensiveness.
Mm-hmm.
So in describing the gap, you factually describe what's occurred, then compare it with what was expected.
Okay.
I noticed today you came in at 8:20. The job requires you to be here at 8. Now, what I'm doing by describing the gap is I'm defining the problem for the person, I'm setting the agenda for our crucial confrontations, and I'm minimizing defensiveness. So back to the dad, honey, you promised me you'd be home at 11:30. It's now 12:10. That's describing the gap. Then the very next skill after describing the gap is you ask a diagnostic question, inviting them to explain why this gap exists. So dad might say, you agreed to me, oh, and by the way, the sequence doesn't matter, whether you describe the expectation or the occurrence first, doesn't matter.
Okay.
So dad might say, you promised me you'd be home by 11:30. It's now 12:10. What happened? And now he's going to listen. Or the employee, you say, I noticed you came in at 8:20. The job requires you to be here at 8. What's going on?
Mm.
And now you listen. We have found that that is one of the safest beginnings you can make to a crucial confrontation that minimizes defensiveness and dramatically increases the probability the person will respond with dialogue rather than respond with violence or silence.
Oh, that's great. That is great.
And isn't that so simple?
It is simple. So that's where the it totally changes the tone of the dialogue.
Yeah.
I love that. Well,
now, it actually starts with your heart because you master your story. Mm-hmm. You get your story right so that your emotional state is one of inquisitiveness and care and interest rather than anger and frustration.
Mm-hmm.
So it actually starts with your heart, getting your story right, questioning your judgments, and then you're ready to open your mouth, and just that simple skill can make the whole difference.
That is an awesome skill. Okay, share with us mistake number 4.
Well, mistake number 4 is often we think we can't speak up because the other person doesn't care about the issue. If I go talk to them, they won't even care. They'll just dismiss my concern.
So that's a prevalent belief?
Oh, yeah, and it's one of the big reasons that people go silent or avoid a confrontation, is it's important to me, but I don't believe it's important to the other person.
Mm.
This is interesting because the problem's compounded if the other person is my boss or the other person's my boss's boss.
Right.
The other person has more power, and so I feel less safe talking to them because they have so much influence over me and my career and my performance appraisal and my job assignment. Imagine in a hospital, if I'm a medical technician that sets the tray for surgery and I realize that what has been asked for does not match the surgery taking place. Well, of course, would say, well, you go point it out to someone and fix it. But what if that someone is a physician, a doctor, most powerful person in this organization, has the power over life and death, and if they just mention my name to an administrator, can get me fired for no reason? Suddenly, I feel very reluctant to question their judgment. I feel very reluctant to question their assumptions. And so I have huge pressure to just not bring it up at all. I'm not sure they'll even care. In fact, this might be my mistake of misunderstanding, and then I'll look stupid. And so I just go silent with it. Or, and this is especially ironic, if I think my spouse doesn't feel my concern is important, often because it's an intimate relationship with a long history, instead of going silent and refusing to confront them, I will decide to make it important by demonstrating my strong emotion. And I'll come in there and I'll yell at them and be so angry and present the problem through a series of accusations and judgments so that they know it's important and to make it important to them. And so the same problem can result in us avoiding a crucial confrontation or having it violently in order to make sure the other person knows how important it is to us.
So what is the solution to that? Restate the solution to that?
The solution is a simple skill that takes a bit of preparation and forethought.
Okay.
It's literally revealing to people the natural consequences of their behavior.
Okay.
A lot of people don't realize that what they're doing that creates a gap for us has consequences to them and the things they care about.
Let's take a look at that doctor, for example, that you mentioned. So the medical technician sees a discrepancy and doesn't say anything.
Yeah. Literally, we have documented an outcome that comes from that behavior.
Mm-hmm.
We documented a woman who was checked into a hospital for a tonsillectomy.
Mm-hmm.
They put her under and then amputated three-quarters of her right foot. When she woke up, saw what had happened, she was hysterical.
Oh, my God.
It was a horrific mistake. When everyone who had anything to do with her care during those 2 days was interviewed,
yes,
there were no fewer than seven people who recognized something's wrong here. Something's
wrong.
Oh,
my gosh.
Including the medical technician who stocked the tray for the surgery.
Oh, my gosh.
And he's going down the list, and he goes, what? Bone saw? They want me to put a bone saw on the tray. Why do you need a bone saw for a tonsillectomy? Oh, well, it's not my decision. And he puts the bone saw on the tray.
Oh, gosh.
Now, if he had spoken up, there's a high likelihood he could have prevented the accident.
Yes.
Later, when these people were interviewed, a question was asked, what does it take to do well around here?
Mm-hmm.
An almost unanimous answer is, mind your business and don't question a physician.
Oh, my gosh.
Now, people believing that story then are directed in their behavior to avoid confrontations with physicians, to do what they're told, to not question, don't rock the boat.
Yes.
At a horrific cost.
Yes.
Now, what's ironic is when you talk to the technician in such a situation, he believes he has only two choices. One is to say to the doctor, you made a mistake. You called for a bone saw. You don't need a bone saw. It's a tonsillectomy. You're in error. And by doing that, he immediately creates defensiveness in the physician who says, who are you to tell me how to do my job?
Mm-hmm.
His choice is either that or go silent and avoid it. And most of us will go silent and avoid it, not recognizing that violence hurts and silence hurts, and there's another alternative that says, what if I go to the physician and say, excuse me, I'm preparing the tray for surgery. I notice on the list it says bone saw, and my understanding is this is a tonsillectomy. Can you help me understand what I should do?
Hmm.
Just a reasonable approach, describing the gap, not being defensive or angry, and asking a diagnostic question, literally that could have created a very different outcome, and the person wouldn't be in trouble for questioning the doctor. He'd be praised for pointing out the problem.
Right. And, you know, it seems to me, Ron, that what's required in that scenario that you just described is that the medical technician has got to have their ego in check. In other words, so that they're not afraid of the doctor looking at them saying, well, of course, stupid.
Yep, they do. Part of having the ego in check, another way of saying that is, number one, I have to have confidence.
Yes.
We have found when people think they have two choices, we call this a sucker's choice. I speak up and get them mad at me, or I go quiet and let the bad thing happen.
Yeah.
Right? Well, avoid the sucker's choice and say, actually, there's a third alternative, and that is I can confront it in an effective way. Most people don't have models for that. However, when they learn a few simple skills, like describing the gap, something we just talked about, they can do that.
Mm-hmm.
They find out when they have those skills, know how to confront in effective ways, suddenly they're confident confronting.
Yeah.
They're not fearful. The technician says, I don't see any probability that this is going to go bad by me respectfully pointing out the discrepancy and asking the physician what she wants me to do, right? All of a sudden, their confidence just rises, and their belief that something good is going to come out of this, rather than their belief that something bad is going to happen if I do, then we find a whole lot of quote-unquote personality problems disappear. A whole lot of quote-unquote weak character issues just disappear, because people are very willing to have a crucial confrontation if it's high stakes and they believe this will have a good outcome. And I believe it'll have a good outcome because I know these skills and I've practiced them and seen them work.
So, crucial confrontations. Tell us, where can people get the book?
Well, it's available at Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com, virtually any bookstore, and if they're out, you can order it there.
Okay. And how do people find out more about you and your team?
I would welcome them to come to CrucialConfrontations.com. You think your listeners could remember that?
I think so. Well, and there'll also be a link next to this interview.
You make it so easy.
And so they can find all your contact information there. And tell us just briefly about the workshop or the training that you do around this. Is how long does this take if an organization says, this sounds like exactly what we need? What is involved with something like that?
Well, I appreciate the invitation to talk about that. If they go to the website, mm-hmm. What they'll find is there's a plethora of resources and tools available to them. There's a button, and you'll love this button. It's called Free Stuff. And if they click that, there's a questionnaire they can take to kind of evaluate where are they good and where do they need to improve when it comes to confrontations. There are video examples they can look at. There's a lot of tools there. One of the tools they'll find on the website is we offer crucial confrontations training.
Mm-hmm.
It's a 16-hour training, and we have these all over the country where people can sign up and come and attend for 2 days, or people in the organizations can be certified and take it inside their organization and train it in 2-hour modules spread over 3, 4, 6 weeks. So it's very easy to deliver. It's very easy for an organization to acquire the ability to deliver it, including certification and the materials. We also have audios of the four authors explaining the content material and giving examples. We have webinars that are no charge that people can sign up on different topics where they come on their computer, pull up the website, and then dial in a toll-free number on their phone, and we can talk, and they can look at slides as we go through it. So they'll find a lot of resources on the website, crucialconversations.com.
Crucial Conversations.
Oh,
yeah.
You know what?
Yes.
That's a different content area, and that will get them to the same place. It's crucialconfrontations.com.
Okay.
Sorry, Tom.
So for our listeners, there's the book that precedes the book that we've been talking about is actually called Crucial Conversations. So, and then there's the book we've been talking about, just for clarity for our listeners, is Crucial Confrontations. And
thank you for explaining that, Tom.
Both of them are fantastic books, and I know that many of the people on listening to this are familiar with Tom Peters, who is a many would call a management guru. I love his material, and he wrote the foreword to this. And Tom Peters, for our listeners, this is what he says: this is a magnificent and groundbreaking masterwork. And he goes on to say that. You might, in his eyes, you should be receiving a Nobel Prize any day soon. So this is just some of what people say about this. And so I'm absolutely excited, Ron, to get your material out to as many people as we can and help people realize that this is an absolutely crucial skill. You've got to get this skill in order to create high-performing teams and to spread this knowledge throughout an organization to create a new culture, because people typically, as you have found, as you've described in this interview, see and view confrontation typically from a place of that it's and approach confrontation in a way that's not sustainable, doesn't enhance relationships. And that's what I love about what you're doing, is that it actually, when you learn these skills, you enhance the relationship.
Done well, a crucial confrontation will solve the problem in a way that makes the relationship even stronger than before you confronted it. I think that's right.
Yes.
And Tom, I'd like to say one other thing to those listening in, and that is there's so much emphasis on individual performance and hiring the star and getting the right person on the bus. Mm. And I would never undermine the importance of that message. And I think the most important work that happens in organizations happens in teams. And your emphasis on teams and helping people find resources to make teams more effective is so needed, and it's of such vital importance. I appreciate you kind of highlighting some skills that will help teams work more effectively together. I think the skills and all of the models and admonitions you put together for effective teaming can dramatically improve people's effectiveness. So I hope they'll pay attention.
Thank you, Ron. Well, it's I see it as we're all out there, I think, doing our part. And I hope that more people see that if there was ever a time in our history that we need to learn and practice skills like what we've been talking about these past 50 minutes, is that now is the time. Now is so much the time that we've got to learn these skills and practice them.
Yep.
So, well, Ron, thank you so much for your time. And again, this is Tom Heck with TeachMeTeamwork.com, and we've been talking to Ron McMillan, who is the co-author of Crucial Confrontations. And you can learn more about this book and Ron's work at CrucialConfrontations.com. And you can get the book at Amazon.com and any large book distributor. And Ron, thanks again.
Thank you, Tom.
All right. Thank you for our listeners, and make sure that you check out Ron's book as soon as you can. This is Tom Heck with TeachMeTeamwork.com signing off.